Lazy Point. Isn't Long Island just a place of strip malls and, you know, big highways and railroads that go slow?
It's all of those things, but it's also really beautiful bays and really spectacular nature. And the east end of Long Island is still a very special place, you know. And I think as the migrating birds and the migrating fish see it, they probably just see some people coming and going. But to them, it's still the power place, the leading edge of their migrations. And they still come and go as they have for quite a few thousands of years.
Why a view from Lazy Point? Why should the bulk of your new book be about your experience there in your backyard? Your backyard, where you do point out that you can see the sun rise and set over the ocean.
Yeah. Well, it is a beautiful place, and the energies from all these migrants really, you know, it gives me sanity and solace and delight and hope, and also more than a few fresh meals, because not all my interaction with nature is strictly observational. I do like to go fishing. I like to go clamming. I like to bring some of it home to the table. But I think that any observant person can see the world from wherever they are and really whatever they're doing. That just happens to be what I do a lot of the time. And it's home. It's just a setting for the rest of the book, which, as you mentioned, goes from the Arctic to the Antarctic and across the tropics. So it's very local and it's very global at the same time. And despite all the gloom and doom that we hear about the environment, I wanted to show that the world is still brimming with living vitality and that there's a lot left to save and a lot that really is worth working on. But the trends are troubling because there are a lot of things at stake and we are losing a lot.
Now, if I were out at Lazy Point, what would I see in terms of migrations? And why, by the way, is Lazy Point such a great place to watch migrations?
Well, you know, the east end of Long Island kind of just sticks out into the ocean. And so there are a lot of things that come across the water. There are fish that come up along the coast. And they all have to round that end. And Lazy Point is right near the end. So it is a real concentration point. And that's why it's a great place to be stationed to see these things. And the sky is very open. And, you know, the world is just sort of there for the taking.
Tell me about the terns and the monarch butterflies you see at Lazy Point.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I've worked on terns for a long time. I did my PhD research on tern foraging and way before that. And the reason I got interested in terns in the first place was that as a teenager, I used to follow them around because where the terns are diving is where the fish are. And so they live there, but they, you know, they only live there during their breeding season. And then the rest of the year, they are migrating or at their wintering grounds. And terns are very long-distance migrants. They go down to South America, and they live an astonishingly long time. A tern that I banded in the early 80s was recovered breeding on a nest just 10 miles from Lazy Point on an island there. That tern was 27 years old, and it really floored me. I mean, it had survived all of those migrations. It had managed to find what it needed all of those years, evade all of the predators and all of the bad weather and everything else. And, you know, these birds live out in the weather 100% of the time. They never go into any cover. They don't have any shelter or burrows or anything like that. They're just out there. And to live that long and travel that many thousands of miles and raise so many broods of young ones is a very, very impressive feat for any living thing. And then you also asked about the migrating monarch butterflies, which come along the beach in the fall, sometimes really quite a few of them. In good years, you can sometimes see hundreds at a time. And they have a very bizarre migration. It takes them four generations to make the whole migration. I don't know anything else like that, but one generation starts in Mexico. They hatch, they come north, they breed in the southern United States, they hatch, go farther north, they breed around where we are. The ones that hatch where we are go into Canada, and then the ones that hatch in Canada make a migration down to Mexico. It's absolutely staggering. And then to, you know, to actually just see the butterflies themselves fluttering against the ocean breezes and constantly going in one direction, which is down the beach toward the south, which on Long Island is mostly west. So somehow they know that going west will take them south as the coast bends. And how they do this and how they know, or whatever it is that makes them go, is just miraculous.
So it would be like if humans decided to explore other solar systems and decided to have generations of people travel, because we don't live long enough to get there, even close to light speed. And so that four or five generations of humans it would take aboard some spaceship to get to some other part of the galaxy. That's the way the monarch lives its life, it sounds like.
I never thought of it that way, but that's a pretty good analogy.
Now, you're really into turns. They're professional dancers on the ocean, by the way. That's my view of them. They just seem
that's
to
a good one.
Swirl
that's a good one.
And twirl and make their moves. They're so intricate with each other. Tell me about the Arctic terns you saw in your year of travels.
Well, the Arctic terns have the longest migration of anything in the world, and they see more daylight than anything in the world. They breed in the Arctic and or the subarctic, but many of them do go very far north for breeding. And then they fly really all the way across the world, and they spend the winter in the subantarctic or in Antarctic waters. And they, you know, they're really the extreme among these birds. And then, you know, they don't look very tough. They look really graceful and really beautiful.
In the course of your book, you talk about a number of environmental problems, but you also really focus on the positive. And there's a particular moment as you're traveling. You wind up in the South Pacific, in the island of the islands of Palau there. And I'm thinking of your discussion of the parrotfish and the corals there. Can you talk to us a bit about that relationship?
Yeah, one of the problems around the world is that coral reefs are dying, and they're dying because of a few different things. They're dying because it's getting too hot for them. They're dying because the ocean pH is getting too acidic for them. And those two problems are from the fossil fuels that we burn and the carbon dioxide that results. They're also dying because they are overfished. And for quite a few millions of years, what we think of as coral reefs in the modern sense have been possible because of a family of fish called parrotfish. And their teeth are fused together into these scrapers. And what they do for a living mainly is they scrape algae that is constantly trying to grow on the corals. So where there are a lot of parrotfish, which is the normal natural state of affairs, they are constantly scraping away almost all the algae. And that allows the corals to grow. When people catch too many parrotfish and too many other fish, there are not enough of them to keep the lawn mowed, and the weeds start growing. Where the weeds grow, they cast shade on the corals, and the corals need light to survive. And baby corals need hard surfaces to get started. So the seaweed begins to kill the corals, and it makes it almost impossible for young corals to get a foothold and survive. And what is not obvious, unless you really study it, and unless you really study it in different places in the world, and I was able to travel to different reefs in the world with a fantastic scientist from Maine called Bob Stenick, who showed me all of this, is that the difference between a weedy reef and a coral reef is, does it have enough parrotfish? Palau has had a very good policy of keeping the limits on fishing within the right parameters so that the reefs still have a lot of fish. They did that mainly because they're really famous as a tourist destination for scuba diving. But what they got in addition to the tourists was they kept their coral reefs.
And why did Palau decide to keep its coral? Why did Palau decide to put in this restraint in the fishing that was going on there?
Well, they just were afraid that if the reefs were as cleaned off of fish as they are in many other parts of the world, that the tourists would stop coming. And the tourists mean a lot of dollars to those islands in Palau. So they were mainly concerned about maintaining their status as a really premier scuba diving destination. But what they didn't realize fully, although now it's understood, is that leaving enough fish on the reefs made it possible for the reefs themselves to exist and also to recover from coral bleaching, which killed a lot of the corals when the water got too hot a few years ago. So you're not only maintaining the reefs, but you're also building in resilience. If it wasn't for all those fish, the reefs would not have been able to come back from that die-off. The corals would not have been able to regrow. Baby corals would not have been able to get established if it was not for all of those parrotfish. But because they had the fish kept the reefs grazed and kept it clean of seaweed, and the corals were able to recover when something bad happened to them.
It's amazing that amid all the doom and gloom about what's happening to coral reefs, the acidification of the ocean, the rising temperatures, the overfishing, that we have this story from Palau that things are so much better. What's it like in the Caribbean for these coral reefs?
In the Caribbean, with the exception of Bonaire, which similarly to Palau and how Palau kept its fish, Bonaire banned spearfishing all the way back in the 1960s. And so Bonaire still has a lot of fish and some pretty good coral, but there are a lot of problems with the reefs in the Caribbean. And even Bonaire has not been exempted from the problems of corals dying because of diseases. Some of the corals there have died. But in other parts of the Caribbean, most of the corals have died. Most of the reefs have been overfished. And many of the reefs that were once really these crystal clear, beautiful coral reefs are now mounds of coral rubble with some live coral and a lot of seaweed growing on them. So the process is that they're going from coral reefs, which they have been for several hundred million years, to seaweed rubble mounds. And once they do that, they can't just flip back to coral reefs very easily. It's kind of like a permanent shift, and it's very, very troubling.
And what do we lose when we lose the corals?
Well, we lose one of the most incredible types of habitat on Earth that is the home to millions of other species. We lose the ability of coral reefs to be a protection and a buffer to shorelines and low-lying settlements when there are hurricanes or tsunamis. And the big tsunami that hit the Indian Ocean, the towns that survived best were the ones where the coral reefs were still intact because they were able to absorb a lot of the energy before it hit the town. And not to mention the fish that sustained people.
Your book is about science and intertwined ecosystem, but, you know, it kind of reads like an adventure novel at times. And I'm wondering if there's a favorite place that you visited over your year in the course of writing this book that you'd like to talk about.
My favorite place really was Southeast Alaska. It's such a beautiful place. It has these incredible forests. It has these snow-capped peaks and glaciers that John Muir said that they were so beautiful that it seemed that no one had ever even looked at them before. It's full of salmon. It's full of bears. The most common bird you see in many places is the bald eagle. It's an absolutely wonderful place, and yet it's not an incredibly remote wilderness. Wherever you go, you see people in boats. You see planes. You see people going up into the streams to fish. We're there with our modern contrivances, but the difference is that we did hurt that place, and we realized that we were hurting it, and we pulled back, and we had the luxury of pulling back and letting some of the forests recover and letting a lot of the salmon runs recover and protecting the bears because there were few enough people to give us the luxury of doing the right thing so that the place could remain in perpetuity and people could continue to really, really deeply enjoy it. And to me, that's the model of how I wish the whole world would be.
Tell me about your travels to Antarctica. You spent some time with the penguin scientists Wayne and Sue Trivelpeace. What was that like?
Antarctica, I think, is the most different place in the world. And, you know, the ice and snow make everything seem so clean and pristine. The birds are fantastic, these big colonies of penguins. They're stinky, they're noisy. There's life and death everywhere. Everything seems really so vivid. I was with them while they were studying the penguins' relationship to their main food supply, which is a little shrimp-like thing called krill. And what they were finding is that as the Southern Ocean warms up and the ice shrinks, there are fewer krill, because when the krill are young, they make a living by grazing the algae from the underside of sea ice. So if the sea ice shrinks 10%, that's 10% less food for krill. And what they were learning was that the penguins, whose food they were measuring, we would catch these penguins and we would sort of wash the food out of their stomachs so that we could measure the size and the amount that they were bringing back, that they were getting fewer krill, and that their young ones were not surviving as well. They were the first people I'm aware of who understood that the penguins' food supply was being affected by the shrinking ice, and that the young penguins are not surviving their first year as well as they had been. So the penguin populations are starting to decline. Penguins are moving around, trying to find places where there are still a lot of krill for them. And all of this is part of the effect of the warming of the polar regions. The polar regions are warming a lot faster than the temperate regions. And everyone who lives or works in the Arctic or the Antarctic really feels climate changing on a year-to-year basis. You know, Wayne was also the first person who ever pointed out to me a glacier that he explained how much bigger it was when he first got there 20 years earlier. Now I've heard that same story in a lot of places, in Alaska and in the Norwegian Arctic. A lot of places where there are glaciers, people have stories about how much bigger they used to be.
Now, in your book, you go so far as to compare our current economic dependence on fossil fuel, oil and coal, to our economic dependence on slavery. Can you explain that to me?
Well, we crossed a bridge before in this country, and in fact in Western civilization, where people were saying, you know, you can't change our energy base or the economy will fall apart. The economy will be destroyed because we need cheap energy. But the cheapest energy we've ever had was slaves. We fought a war over it. And energy is always a moral issue. It's a moral issue now as well. The consequences of the energy that we use really affect people and will really, really affect people who are not here now to defend their interests. They're not born yet, or they're very young, but they will be saddled with the consequences, and we are shrinking their options. We are stealing the future from them, and we're possessing their time on this planet, just like we possessed the lives of people who were made to work for us. We were told that the economy would not survive a switch away from slaves, and we're told now that the economy will not survive a switch away from fossil fuels, even though fossil fuels are actually endangering the ability of the planet to maintain civilization and the stability of the world around us. We're using a very, very expensive and really not moral form of energy, and we're telling each other that it's what we have to use because it's cheap. And that's the same argument that people who had slaves used.
So things are bad, but we still have a chance to turn them right, you're saying, Carl Savina.
Where there's life, there's hope. You know, that's a truism, and it is true. There's a lot left. But the trends are serious, and we need to revalue and re-evaluate our relationship with nature. And I think that the main conclusion I came to at the end of this year of observation and of travel is that nature and human dignity require each other. Where people are oppressed, where they have horrible dictators, where the destruction of the land around them makes them so poor that living day to day is the only thing they can think about, they can't afford to take care of nature. On the other hand, where the nature and the natural systems can continue to produce for people and provide them with beauty and food and water and the things that we need, we can think about the higher things and we can live a dignified existence. And we can take care of the natural world around us, like I was mentioning in Southeast Alaska, or even in just looking at the United States or the West. People have best taken care of their natural environment in democracies. It takes free people to take care of the world around them. And likewise, where the world around them is devastated, that's often where you have these terrible governments that have the opportunity to come in. So, as I say, nature and human dignity seem to require one another. Our community is not just the people around us. It's us, it's the living world, and it's the generations that will come after us. We are just the current iteration in a long chain of being. We owe everything about us to the people before us. And we have a responsibility to the people who will come after us as well.
We're just one generation of the monarch butterflies.
That's right. We're just one generation of those monarch butterflies, those space travelers.
Carl Safina's new book is called The View from Lazy Point, A Natural Year in an Unnatural World. Thank you so much, Carl.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
And just for the tape, you know, who knows? So Aldo Leopold writing in a Sand County almanac kills a wolf and, well, you tell the story.
He and some other people were on a hillside and they saw a wolf swim across a stream below them. And as he said, in those days, they had never heard of passing up an opportunity to kill a wolf. When she got to the other side, her pups came out from the cover, and they greeted her, and within moments, as he said, they were pumping lead into the pack. He got down to them just in time to see the female, who was mortally wounded, dying, and he said that the fierce green fire going out of her eyes made a lifelong impression on him, that he had done something wrong, that he had intervened in something that was old and that worked and that was right, and it taught him something he never forgot.
And how does that compare to your experience with the Mako?
I think, you know, rather inadvertently, I had a very similar experience with that Mako shark. And I, like him, he had killed other wolves and I had killed other Makos. There was just something about when it happened, I guess, in where our lives were taking us and our thinking was taking us, that was similar, because I had killed other sharks and felt really thrilled about it. But that one, I knew that it just wasn't the right thing anymore.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.